So we will help you by seeing if we can't do something. Please come up here to Washington, tell us about it. So he came up, and in those days, there was... Do you know that when the war broke out, we had only 250 airplanes in this country, passenger airplanes, 250 of which about 200 were DC-3s, the old one that would seat a maximum of about 21 people. They would fly only by the daytime. They came into Brownsville, Texas, and he got to Brownsville where everybody was being searched as import, passing customs. And he said, "Do you mean they're going to look in my briefcase?" And somebody said, "Of course, going to look through everything, look everything in your body." He said, "Oh, gee, I feel sick." So he said, where's the toilet? They showed him where the toilet was. He went in there, was 15 minutes flushing all his papers down the john. But anyway, the State Department, he did get to Washington. They did say, well, we got to, and they did have my name because I had been on two or three other excursions of equal interest but nonsense as far as the war effort was concerned to South America. And so they said, "Dr. Othmer, will you go down?" And I said, "Yes, I will. But I'm not a microbiologist. And I'm an engineer. I can engineer the plant, but I got to have somebody." So he said, "Okay, you find the microbiologist. We'll ask him to go." So I did find a fellow, a chap named Underkoffler. Lee Underkoffler, who's long since retired, at later time I got him a job as a chief chemist and production manager of a fermentation plant over in New Jersey, and he wrote the classic book on biotechnology, fermentation, and similar things. Well, Lee Underkoffler went down, and I, and he went first. I couldn't get away for some reason. He went first, went to Guatemala City, saw the fellow. Nothing there seemed to be a good place, but he was recommended then to the United Fruit Company. And I heard from him before I left. He was down in San Pedro Sula, in Honduras, right down on the coast in the Mosquito area, so that's where I met him. And this happened to be the research center of the United Fruit, the best place in Central America to do any such work. So I went down. This was February of 1944. It was awfully cold in New York, and I went down and had a wonderful time, and so did Lee. Missing all the cold weather. I was a bachelor, by the way, then. I married rather late. Anyway, we did find that you can make a gallon and a half or thereabouts of alcohol from a stem of bananas, and they had millions of stems of bananas, and United Fruit Company, as a labor palliative and to keep people happy, kept people employed. And they went around and chopped the bananas, let them fall and rot. And they had all the equipment to bring the stems in and so on. And so everything was there and so on. It was merely the question of where we build a plant. I looked around and found that there was an old alcohol plant that, oddly enough, had been built by the father the president. He was still the president of this Vulcan company in Cincinnati. He built it before the war. Oh, well, before the First World War. He built it there on the coast of Honduras. It didn't work out. We came back, made our report. But the interesting thing, and I can't but tell you this story, and you leave it in or not, but it's interesting to me. We were there for a month. And the United Fruit, we worked, they closed early the laboratory, and Lee Undercoffer did a wonderful work in his fermentation technology and studying it all. And we stayed at the house. They had a little hotel-like, a wooden framework house, and we lived there. I had an excellent room, and he did, maybe 30, 40 rooms for maybe not that many. And we were entertained nicely by the manager of United Fruit, which was quite an industry, very great industry there. And we got over to San Pedro Sula, and I met the mayor and had some wonderful experiences. But when we came to leave after a month, we would get through with work about 3:30, I think they quit. They started at 7, and so before dinner we would stop in the bar and play poker dice, we never played for money, but we would play to match a drink. Drinks were like beer 5 cents and whiskey 10 or something like that. We never drank too much either, but it was fun. So I always hate to pay money out. I'm not stingy about amounts of money. It's just that I hate shopping. I hate paying out. So I would always sign my chit. And of course, we didn't pay anything at the bar. We were going to pay when we leave, and we were going to pay everything else. So we came the morning that I was leaving. Undercoffer and I didn't leave at the same time for some reason of connection, so I was going to Mexico and stopped there on something else. But anyway, I saw the manager of this hotel or little hostelry, and then the boss of the place, and said, I'm leaving at noon, and I'd like to pay my bills. He said, I'd like to pay my room. And he says, you're a guest of United Fruit. I said, oh, no, I'm not a guest of United Fruit. I'm working for the Department of State. I'm paid by the government of the United States. Oh, he said, yes, but my orders is you're the guest. I say, well, let me pay my meal bill then. No. He said, you didn't understand. I said, well, then I'll pay my bar bill. He said, no, you are the guest. You don't understand. You'll have to, that's my orders. You'll talk to the manager. I went and talked to the manager. The manager said, look, Dr. Othmer, we have been in the banana business. We spend many, many millions and hundreds of millions of dollars in ships and everything. We never studied their fermentation. And this little experiment, which is we're not paying for, is such your keep here is such so small an amount compared to just the fact that what you tell us and so on. Well, okay, sir. But here, I don't know as I was ever more embarrassed than to find I'd had a bar bill running for a month and find that it was all on the house. Well, anyway, that's that. But, oh, when I came back, I'd had a very interesting, a wonderful apartment on Brooklyn Heights. It was a whole floor of a building. It had views on all four sides and a private elevator entrance, and so on. A very nice, but I had it for a very low cost because rents had been very cheap when I made the lease, and the deal was always that I would always meet any if they could sell it. Meanwhile, what happened in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, Wall Street over there was in the engineering offices. All the engineering offices were in Lower Manhattan, so just across the water. So everything, the real estate, went up, up, up. And when I got back, there were two special delivery letters for me, registered letters. Well, first one, I put them in order. One was 10 days apart. Please come in and see about renewing your lease, or that is, making a new lease. The other one was, since you didn't come in due to our first letter, we have rented your apartment. Please get out. And I shrugged my shoulders because I'd been living around there as a bachelor, and I knew I had a little black book with a dozen places that were all taken. And I then went over, went to a real estate agent then, and he said, there's no place here. I got a couple of numbers, and he gave me this number, that, 140. But nobody wants that. He said that it was just the first floor. The first floor of the house, of this old house, had built 1830 or something. And nobody wants it. It's so dark in the middle room and so on and so on. And it has many other disadvantages. So when I looked at it and I saw the view, I said, well, that's it. So I had to, so I then persuaded the landlord, actually lived in California, retired, and I had to make a deal. The history of the house was very interesting, which I won't go into, but I did make a deal with a 170-word telegram, and I got a wire back, yes, you can do anything you want to in this floor, but you can't make it so that it cannot be used again as a one-family house. You see, it had been always a one-family house, well, up to 5 years before that or something. So anyway, that was when I got that. And then I was married. That was in 44, February. I was married in 50. I lived there as a bachelor, you see. And then when we were married, my wife, Mid, came to live with me on that floor. And then in 58, again, the house had changed hands, but again to an oldster who wanted to sell it, and I was afraid I would have to buy it. And I couldn't get any of the people in the house to go along. So we had to buy it. I didn't want to be a landlord, but we then did take it over. So we've always lived there. And it's a 20-minute walk, as you know, from here. And, of course, I probably will always live there. And even though we ought to leave because Mid has bad arthritis and should be in a dry climate, she doesn't want to leave, and I don't want to. We have too much junk to move.
Many years of accumulation.
Mm.
Just a few quick questions to close, I think. I have a couple comments that you made. One in particular, which I was intrigued by. You said conversion of wood to energy was your ticket into the chemical industry. And then you followed that up by saying that many new ideas in biomass conversion are really reinventions of the chemical wheel, no better than they were 50 years ago. Hoyt Hoddle said the same thing about solar energy, which he worked in many years ago, and has said within the last 2 years essentially the same thing. We're just reinventing what we already know. Do you have any other comments about that?
Well, what I would say would be merely a reiteration and giving examples of it, which I don't know are too pertinent. Everything, every big strike or interest in chemical industry comes up, or chemical thought for chemical engineers comes into being, and then it passes on. This was something interesting during the war. My friends in the Vulcan Company did build a plant for the war, a big plant during the war out in Washington for converting wood into alcohol, and that only lasted as long as it was government financed, just long enough to be sure that the technology was there. And I don't know if there's been any improvements much since then. Bacterial systems have been, and enzyme systems have been tried, but they never found bacteria or enzymes that were good enough in devouring these cellulose and giving us off products, alcohol. So I don't think there really is much to add to that, except that it is certainly a fact. I would let me mention one other thing about that I think is involved in the history. We have done a tremendous amount of travel. One reason for that was in the early 50s. Did I mention Burma?
No.
In the early 50s, I was asked to make what amounted to a survey and report on the chemical potentiality, interests, demands, needs, and program for Burma. Burma was about 23 million people at that time. And so they wanted me to go out, bring med, of course, and spend 3 years in Rangoon. It was going to give us a big house with 8 servants right on the lake, which is a very desirable residential area. And that would be my job for at least 3 years. I said, no, I can't. I was head of the department. I can't go. But I can do that sort of work better in New York if I get out there from time to time to get the facts. So what happened is we went there 2 or 3 times a year to Rangoon. Well, Rangoon is just halfway around the world. And so we always went around the world because I had many, many contacts and contracts and work to be done in Japan, usually something in Germany or Denmark or Spain. As I said, I was married in 50, and during the first 12 years of our married life, I took my wife around the world 13 times. I had gone around the world in the summer of 50, before we were married, to be sure it was round, and it turned out to be. And so we had many, many good times in Japan, always the guests of the big companies, but doing this job in Burma. at that time, one of my friends who just last year got the my former student, who just this last year got his the Perkin Medal, Dr. Regna, had been with others developing terramycin with Pfizer, and the manager, the chief chemical engineer and manager of production, was another chemical engineer by the name of Herman Poitras, who happened for quite other reasons. Not academic, I never knew him from school, but for other reasons was very good friend. It came about through his wife being a friend before my wife was married and so on. And so we were good friends. And before we went to Burma, the last time, as a matter of fact, in 53, we were at their house over in Saddle River, New Jersey. And he said, Don, he said, we've just been making some funny things, pills, something like penicillin. I got a lot of them up here, 50 or 100 of them, the pills that were irregular and couldn't be sold. And maybe you ought to take them with you. Take a few of them with you, half a dozen. You might run into a need. So we went there. This business in Burma I could extol for a long time. It was crazy. And all the work we did, and almost killed myself there, overworking in that particular summer. Always had to be, every time you went out of the country, you had to have shots for typhus. And when I was a youngster, 16 years old, I'd had typhoid fever. And so the typhus shots never made any deal with me. I was very much run down then in Burma, and it was hot awfully and so on. And I went and had a typhus shot. As I say, I was very run down physically. I later had to have my heart taken out and fitted out and so forth. And that was coming on, I didn't realize. But anyway, I called in this... I went to the doctor's office. I forget his name. He was an Indian that I had been working with because he seemed to be know more about any pharmaceutical or chemical industry than anybody else. All he was a practicing a physician. Went to him, gave me a shot. In a few hours, I became deathly sick. What had happened, as I say, my heart was failing, and I was down, maybe then, I was down to 60% of my normal energy. I knew I was going downhill, didn't know what it was. But I didn't think anything about taking this shot. It went to work on me, and I got a tremendous fever, and they got him there in the middle of the night, the same doctor, the best doctor available, in the Strand Hotel, and he didn't say anything. He just said, "I don't know what can be done. You got a fever, and I don't understand," and so on. And I said, "Well, I got these pills. I gave him the name Terramycin. He'd never heard of it, of course." He said, "I of course have no idea." Well, I said, "I understand." So I took one of them, and then I took one another 4 hours. I had no idea what the dosage ought to be. And you know, the next morning that fever was gone. But anyway, I never have told Peter Regney that story. Sometime I'm going to tell him. But that he then also was important in the development of streptomycin and so on. Well, that work in Burma meant thousands of pages of reports, all of which just, I'm sure, were filed away. Nothing ever happened. They've all since rotted away in their storage systems. The point was, just then, Burma was going commie, and that was the reason for being interested. The government paid all of my expenses and my fees or salary fees outside of Burma. The Burmese paid all the fees in there, but it was going commies. We met and spent time with the Russian ambassador to Burma, which was, they were just then getting it under their influence, and then he, having done that job, was moved to be the ambassador of Yugoslavia, which was a much greater post. The point being that since then, of course, Burma is so socialistic and so on. Well, the economics and the fertilizers and the other things that we went into about Burma was really fascinating, but too long a story.
You want to talk about those a little bit?
What's that?
You want to talk about those a little bit?
We went there, as I say, two or three times a year for several years. And that, the more important thing, because while I did this work, sugar refineries, fertilizer plants, you had to question where you get the raw materials, the cost, and so on, the fertilizer. I'm a capitalist, and I was recommending to the commie government there that they make fertilizer and give it away free to every farmer. I'm a capitalist. The reason was, I was working for a commie government. The commie government will say, grew five, well, the first point was they were only growing two-thirds as much rice as they would grow with fertilizer. Their ratio was about one-third about two-fifths, about 40%. Their ratio as to Japan was only about a third, and they could get two crops a year while in Japan only one. But anyway, here was the point. The ratio, the domestic market was so low as compared to their export market. And so therefore, the people of Burma could only eat so much rice. The government would buy it at the local price. I won't go into the figures, but as you can see, if they would get, I figured they would get 60% more rice by fertilizing. That 60% more rice would all be sold on the outside market for about three times the value in the local market. Well, you give the farmers the fertilizer, and you get not 60% more export, but you get not 60% plus twice as much. You see what I mean? That you get so much more to export, so your profit on your export would be so much. They never built a fertilizer plant. Never have. Well, there was some other things. I figured this, that every Burmese woman had to have six children. Every Burmese woman had to have six children. Why? Two were lost in infancy, or in childbirth, and two were lost before they came to biological fulfillment. And so the other two made man and wife to perpetuate this awful... DDT, of course, saved so many lives there. I mean, and I guess it's still used in Burma, I hope so, because it's the only way they can take care of themselves. But the disease rate and so on. They were such lovely people. I never got to know them. Never got to know anybody intimately. Never was to a Burmese house. Nobody in Burma at that time, I was told, had an income of $50,000. Nobody had $50,000 in the country. All they had these, but everybody was so lovable. They called them the Irish of the East, the joviality, the friendliness, the Blarney, and so on. Men, nobody wanted to do any work. They didn't need to. And yet they were so generous. Everybody had a bottle of water and a bag of rice hanging on their gate out in the country or any place else. So any beggar could come along and have a water and rice. But as I say, nobody wanted anything. All they wanted from the United States was motor cars, which they never could afford. And secondly, gory Western movies. Well, anyway, that was an experience in Burma.
You once said that, I think it was in 1977 in your Chemical Pioneer Address, my generation has been fortunate in being part of the most interesting period of life on Earth, past or future.
Life on Earth?
Past or future. And I was just going to close by asking you if you have a crystal ball or what you might see in the future in the profession and how things have changed in your long career.
Well, I still... I feel that very much. Maybe it's because I'm an optimist and have always enjoyed what I did. Never had to do anything that I didn't want to. I mean, everything that I've had to do has always been... I've taken in stride and enjoyed it so on. So this has been a pleasure. It has been an interesting... I remember, of course, before the First World War, and the so on. I don't remember the bad parts of misery and hovels, and I do know that when I got into the charcoal industry, after I'd been with Eastman Kodak, and while I first came here, the most of the charcoal was sold to the cold water flats, as we were called, in Lower Manhattan. That meant places where there was no no gas and no hot water. And charcoal was used as the cooking fuel in thousands and tens of thousands of flats in Manhattan. That was in the 30s. So I didn't know intimately how bad that was. Certainly it's better now, even though most people can still cry that for the well. Anyway.